Hello, you're listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name's Andrew, and I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
And today's episode is our winter 2023 anime season reviews. It's time. It's time to dive through them. I'm sorry, Chris. I can't wait any longer.
I know.
We got to review these for the podcasters. They're like, waiting. I can't push it back any further. You watched most of Onimai, though. You got a good chunk.
I finished it.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, I thought I asked you about the whole thing with the Halloween, and I must have said that wrong. You got me scared.
No, I thought you were asking if I had watched the Halloween thing
before. Okay, that's right. I think I was kind of that way.
I got it out of order, guys. I was watching it, and my video player did a randomize, and I watched the last episode at, like, the fourth, where it should have been the fourth episode or something like that, and it flowed well. It didn't matter at all.
Because it was technically closer to the manga, so technically, that's why I was telling him, like, technically the onsen was supposed to be after the Halloween episode, so it makes sense to be that early. He's like, why suddenly there's a friend? I'm like, yeah, that's technically how it was, so it works. But yes, it is time to do the winter reviews. But yeah, as usual, we're at otakuspread.com. That's where you can go for all of our links, social media links, Discord, ways to support us. We greatly appreciate everybody that supports the channel and all that we do. We recently hit 10,000 subs on YouTube. Yay! Pachi, 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 pachi. No, pachi, pachi?
I'm...
You could just say pachi, pachi. Just, thank you. Gosh, golf clap me, everything. Chris doesn't care. Now, I will say it's partly because a certain video went viral about Princess Connect being shut down by Crunchyroll Games, but I'll take it. I'll take what I can get. The only thing that sucks about it is I promised everybody a room tour the moment I hit 10,000 subs, and it came way too early. Like, I was not expecting it to hit in the middle of first impressions, so be patient, but it is happening. It is now happening.
And technically, most of my stuff is up in Andrew's room, so you all get my stuff while you're doing his stuff.
That's the other part that's making it difficult, because I just literally re-flipped the entire setup, and so things were, like, hectic for a while. So, yeah, just be patient. It's coming, but yes, if you're not there already, youtube.com/otakuspirit is where we're at. And, yeah, I hope you guys enjoy the content, and when the room tour happens, it'll be there. But yes, thank you everybody for your support and getting to that milestone. It's one of the biggest ones, I think, for an early creator, is just hitting that 10,000 point. Granted, yes, I'd love 100,000, love 500,000, a million, but I'm happy what we've gotten to so far. So hopefully it keeps growing. And hopefully all the people that have subbed because of that video want the other content, because I had said in the video, I don't cover mobile games, so don't get that impression. I cover anime. So if you want anime, sub. If you want mobile games, don't sub. But, yeah, it was a lot of fun, though. It's been crazy. I think it's already hit, like, 66,000 views on that one video. So it's like, yeah, it's a bit unexpected, but I'll take it. I'll take what I can get. Anyways, we're here for winter reviews, though. So let's dive into it. We'll see how many can get through in this session. And, yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the reviews. And thanks for popping on here and listening. But let's start off with Bungo Stray Dogs' fourth season. Let's kick it off with a banger. Why not? Because it's in the order of my outline document for doing videos, and so it's going to be in a really dumb order. But yes, Bungo Stray Dogs, streaming on Crunchyroll for 13 episodes, and of course, this is the fourth season of Bungo Stray Dogs. For those that don't, I have an idea about Bungo Stray Dogs. It essentially is opening up in this one city where you have sort of different groups of people that all kind of control what's going on in the world, in the city itself. You have, during the day, it's pretty much the military and the police and the government. You have at night, it's this port mafia, which is this group of people. And then they sort of kind of lay out that there's this kind of middle area of what this protection agency kind of does. And that is what this group is that we kind of follow from the very beginning. We follow Atsusushi, who joins that group, learns about them. And the oddity in this world is that there's these people known as the Gifted. And Gifted are people that have, like, special abilities, like able to write anything into a book and it creates it. You have somebody that can heal people's wounds. You have people that just different things that sort of alter reality of the world itself, just different abilities. And yeah, it's going into the fourth season now. what kind of encompasses the fourth season? We have the introduction. We have the first creation of the agency itself, where we find out when the current owner first created it. Then we get to the perspective of the introduction of Rampo, when he first met Rampo, which I thought was fantastic. And then it gets into the current time, which is when something they've been hinting at for a long time finally comes into play. This new group shows up out of nowhere. They want to destroy the agency. And so they're using this one thing to sort of make everybody hate the agency. They become the enemy of the entire world, essentially. So they're trying to figure out how to undo that. And yes, that me saying it that way, yes, it's still going. Fifth season is supposed to come in July, so this isn't a complete story. But so far, what I've gotten is very satisfying. Had a great kind of bookend to this season itself. It is literally the best season of Bungo Stray Dogs yet. First season, I enjoyed. Second season, I really enjoyed. The introduction of the guild and everything was fantastic. And of course, the introduction of Kilka was great. Third season, I struggle with the very beginning section, but I love the later part. Fourth season is by far the best yet. This is one of those writers that as they go along, they get better and better and better and better. It's proof. Fourth season was shocking. They had such great writing in there. And I think the core thing that makes me love Bungo Stray Dogs the most is that this writer knows how to make a ton of characters, but make them all purposeful. Like every time a scene changes, I see a character that I haven't seen in a while, I go, oh, it's that character. I know they hate this group. I can't wait to see what they think about the situation. Like, it's not like My Hero Academia. My Hero Academia has a lot of characters too. I don't care about most of them when they come on the screen. This is totally different. And even Naruto, most shonens, when there's a lot of cast of characters, I'm mostly like, I don't really care what this character thinks about the situation. And they'll give you an episode to a character and I just don't care. This one, I always love it. The backstories are fantastic. We got into Yasuno and got her backstory, which is great. Like I said, Rampo getting his backstory was fantastic. I just love all these characters. And they're just, it's a great cast of characters. And they all have their own purpose, what they're striving for. Yes, their core concepts are kind of locked to whatever group they're with. Like if they're with the Port Mafia, they obviously care about the Port Mafia. If they're with the agency, they care about the agency. But they're individually their own character. Like Lucy in this season, she's technically of the guild, but now she's with the agency. Semi-spoiler there. She has her own purpose and why she does what she does. I love that fact that some characters can still change sides and choose to follow somebody else. And yes, it's technically a core concept of the fourth season that one character does change his mind on where they want to follow. So through and through, probably easily like over a 9 out of 10 show for me. Almost a perfect show. I'm fine with saying 10 out of 10. This season was phenomenal. I loved it. Shocking moments in it. Very violent at times. It's just a very purposeful show that has so much writing in the characters. And this writer is just magnificent at it. So I highly, highly suggest checking out the series. I joked about it in my top 10 of the season or top 5 of the season that I almost wanted to give this my number one, maybe probably number two, but there's like two other shows this season that were really good. And plus it's always hard to put long running shows above other shows because you're invested. So yeah, highly suggest it. Fantastic series. I want more. Cannot wait for July. So July is already stacked, dude. We got Mushoko. Yep. We got Bungo Stray Dogs. There's several other shows that are coming back. It's just a crazy season. Jujutsu Kaisen for a lot of people is super exciting. So, but yeah, Bungo Stray Dogs season 4. Definitely check it out. The hunting dogs are great. We got an Edis character, Chris. We got an Edis character. She looks like Edis. And she's hot head like Edis, so it works. So anyways, moving on. Imminence and Shadow. This was winter, remember? I think the show like ended the first week of February, so it feels like it was a fall last year show. But yes, Imminence and Shadow was winter. Ended in winter, so it's a winter show. But yes, ran for 20 episodes. That's probably why it ended so early. But done by Nexus, based off a light novel. And the synopsis is basically edgy, edge boy, edgy, edge, and then edgy boy, edge, and then edgy boy, edges, and then edges and atomic.
I think that you're going to get censored. Because you said certain words that...
No, edgy is not good.
No, it's...
Or boy.
No.
Edgy, edge.
That he edges.
He edges things. He edges crops and stuff. Bushes. He's a bush edger, okay? But no, for reals, it essentially follows this guy that's in our modern times, Japan, and he likes this idea of being this Imminence and Shadow, this guy that works in the night and fights bad guys and stuff, but always, you know, keeps his identity a secret. And he obviously runs into what you would run into in our real world. At some point, you meet your limits. You can only get so strong. You can only get so skillful. He even notes the idea that, you know, if I was surrounded by a bunch of people with guns, I'd probably go down really quickly. But as he meets this, like, this wall that he runs into, he gets, like, in a state of, like, insanity, running around in the middle of this forest, and eventually just jumps out in front of a car and gets hit by a car. Jumps forward, he goes into this fantasy world. He is reborn into a fantasy world where there is magic and everything. So now he can finally live out his fantasies of being the Eminence in Shadow, magic and everything. Kind of tries to keep his identity a secret. You know, during the day, he's just a normal boy, very unskillful. He tries to make it out like he's super weak. And at night, he's this Eminence in Shadow and does things and takes out baddies and stuff. And then eventually, he ends up coming across this one, this girl that's deformed into this blob, like this mana, insecurity that he kind of fixes. And then blurts out all this random stuff to make it seem like there's this big conspiracy about this cult of Diablo that is capturing all these bloodlines of these past heroes. And just so happens it's actually true. And this girl ends up kind of recruiting a bunch of other girls, and they make this Shadow Garden group with Cid. And this Shadow Garden end up leaving Cid to kind of pursue the cult of Diablos. He thinks they're just kind of playing along with it. And yeah, come to find out, while he's doing his normal life, while doing the Eminence in Shadow kind of thing, these girls are running off with this Shadow Garden and building this big empire to fight against the cult of Diablo that actually exists. So that's kind of the deal for the series. So what'd you think? This is when you finished, right?
I did not actually finish it.
You were like really close to finishing.
I was close to finishing it. I will be finishing it. Don't get me wrong. I will be doing it.
I will.
I absolutely love this show. The best way I've been able to explain it as far as what I absolutely love about this show is really literally the fact that Andrew kind of hit on is that Cid's kind of delusions are literally the world is reflecting his delusions. He does not believe that his delusions are an actual thing. He just thinks that, oh, hey, well this just kind of worked out that way. But the fact that the delusions are becoming his reality is I absolutely love it. And that is the one thing that I have absolutely just chewed up. And of course the girls are just freaking fantastic. I mean, Delta was when we finally got the reveal of why Delta is this kind of thing that everybody.
So like Delta's moving is like, oh crap. Delta's moving.
Yeah, getting into Alpha was really great. The introduction of the princess and Alexia were fantastic. Cid's kind of weird kind of attempt at kind of becoming this weird background character and still trying to make people underestimate him, and then when it comes down to it, he's actually super strong and all that stuff.
He's atomic, Chris.
I love it. He's atomic.
No, that is the kind of funniest thing about early on was that it's literally when a Chunubio actually becomes powerful. It's literally what it is. He's a Chuni, and then suddenly he's Isekai'd, and suddenly he can be exactly what he's always kind of had this delusion of, which was funny at the early parts of it. And I really did enjoy the earlier segments of this series because I agree with you. I love the aspect of he creates this fake story. The story ends up being actually true. And then these girls just run with it. And I got a kick out of the fact that every now and then they would show back up and he'd be like, oh, they're just playing into my delusions. They don't actually believe in it. They're just kind of humoring me. And then they'll just kind of, they're actually doing something. They're actually doing something. Was always kind of the funny thing. And I always love like whenever they would have, well, okay, this girl's missing. They're probably in one of these hideouts for the cult of Diablo. And he kind of just throws something at the map and then like goes, oh crap, I didn't actually mean to hit it right there. And they go, oh, you want us to figure this out. So it reminded me a lot of Overlord, this idea of Aynes where he would go, I don't really know what they're doing here. And then they would go, he would just kind of turn to one of them and say, well, you go ahead. And then he would go, oh, he's testing me. Well, obviously it's this. He's like, yes, that's true. Yes, you got it. You know, you just kind of play along with it because he doesn't really have an idea of what's actually going on. I always liked that aspect, and I kind of had that feeling with the show. But, the big but, it got old. Sid got old real fast for me, and that's the unfortunate thing. And even though I was covering it weekly, people loved watching my videos, so I kept covering it. That's something I kind of repeated a lot there, was that I just didn't care for Sid after a while. And I believe my issues with Sid kind of reflect on all the characters, but I think because the Shadow Garden, at least their cast, is so grand, and so many of the other girls, like Elixia, Rose, and technically, quote-unquote, Natsumi, these other characters kind of have their own stories. Edis has her own story. Those characters kind of built up, but everybody technically has one joke. Epsilon. Every time Epsilon's on the screen, it's her chest falls off because it's made of slimes. Okay, when Delta shows up, she's just berserk and destroys everything, and then Alpha calls her out, and then she freaks out. Alpha gets on the screen. Alpha didn't really have a joke. She was just kind of the stern character, but Natsumi slash Beta, she's all about making fanfics of Sid and technically ripping off stories from our modern times Japan, or modern time world. They all have a joke and they kind of stick with it. And Sid's the same way. His joke is, I don't want attention. I want to do things at night. But then he does things that are really super flashy, and thus he gets attention. He has this bucket list that he wants to check off. And so whenever something happens, he's like, oh, that's in my bucket list. I'm so excited that I can do this finally. They all have a joke and they just kind of repeat it. His friend, Sid's friend, his background character friend, what's his joke?
He has to go to the bathroom.
No. No, Chris.
Oh, his no, Sid has to go to the bathroom whenever.
Yeah, Sid always has to go to the bathroom whenever something important happens. Whenever his sister is on the stage, he has to go to the bathroom. But no, his friend's always obsessed with money and betting money. And he always loses money. That's his right. joke. And it's always his joke. And they even have this whole scene where they have like this after moment with between Sid and this one character late in the show. And they're having this very important conversation, and you literally, it gets overshadowed because in the background they're dragging his friend away because he bet too much. It's a joke, and it keeps happening. So there's my core problem. My core problem is I don't care for Sid. I know a lot of people love Sid. I just didn't care for him. And the jokes get old, and they repeat the same jokes. Everybody has a joke. What I did love about the show, here we go, positivity, Andrew time. What I did love about the show was Shadow Garden. I love the concept of Shadow Garden. I love this group that's working in the background that is constantly, kind of brushed off by Sid, but actually is building something really huge. And it does, and because of my love for the girls of Shadow Garden and the mixture of the characters, the chemistry there, yeah. and these characters like Elixia and Rose that I do love, the side characters in this show are good. It has me excited for the next season because it does feel like it's finally going to give us a perspective, possibly, of what's going on in the Shadow Garden, because we don't really get a full perspective of exactly what's going on in there. Just these brief moments where the girls show up or they're building a major mall or something like that based on oddities of our world. So,
And that goes into kind of what I was mentioning is the idea of that how the delusions kind of work around Sid, where he's there, but he's not there. He's not really paying that much of attention, and like Andrew was talking about, the one of the girls completely builds this entire empire based around the ideas that he's brought over from the other world. One of the girls is over there playing a piano, and it's apparently based on
ripping off all music. Yes,
there's really cool little tidbits in there that I just absolutely ate up. That's one of the cool things is, the Shadow Garden and how it's building itself up is this kind of empire that's underneath the surface, and a lot of the girls that are the princess and the other girls that are kind of infatuated with Sid, they're constantly talking about these different shadow groups that are in the background, and one of the shadow groups that they keep bringing up is Shadow Garden. They're like, who is Shadow Garden? Why are they doing the things that they're doing? They even point out, until we know who they are, we have to consider them an enemy, because we don't know who they are. We don't know their motivations. We don't know what they are doing.
Can't control them, Chris.
Yeah. And that there's things like that I just love, that they just set that up there and actually are paying attention to it and not just going, oh, well, Shadow Garden beat the bad guys one time, and so therefore they're good guys. No, no, no. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, somebody really doesn't like Shadow Garden. Somebody really doesn't like Shadow Garden. Or mainly Sid. Or Shadow. Technically Shadow. His name's Shadow. Edgy Edge Boy Shadow. But yeah. there you go. I am looking forward to season 2, like I said, because it kind of has instilled the possibility of really developing on the Shadow Garden, and that's, again, what I like about it. This is a really cool example of one of those cases where people believe that because you don't like a main character, why do you watch a show? And it's like, because the main character isn't just the entirety of the show. I enjoy when the character's on the screen. And in fact, I kind of don't like him. I almost hate him because he blows up a lot of things, and I'm assuming he's killing people. I don't know. It doesn't really specify. It's one of those things where everybody just happens to be out of this entire city area when he blew it up. Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
He technically did blow it up. He is atomic.
He is atomic. Atomic is how it goes. Atomic. All right. Time, Chris. It's time. I can finally get to hear Chris's opinion on this show. I've been waiting a whole season, unable to talk to him about it, and it's finally happening. Yes, Oni Mai, I'm now your sister. Or Oni-chan wa Oishimai. This one was done by Studio Bind, of course, who did Mushoku Tensei Java's Reincarnation, kind of their side project with the team, and does not feel like that. So get into more of that. It's based off of a manga. But this opens up with a guy that is a neat. He self-proclaims that he's a home security system because he never leaves home. He just stays in his room and plays Aroga games. And at some point, he wakes up one morning and he is a girl, a very petite girl. And his sister comes in and goes, wow, that worked different than I was expecting it. Yes, his sister, who's like this genius sister, does kind of create a thing that would turn her brother into a girl. And so kind of follows him as he has to learn the ins and outs of being a female now while, you know, dealing with the everything else that kind of comes with it. The good things and the bad things. And he kind of, there's like a few aspects of the story that I kind of point out. There's three core concepts. One is the fact that he was a neet, and now it almost feels like his sister's trying to fix his neetdom by getting him out of his room and let him explore the world. You have this undertones about the fact that his sister really adored her brother and actually is a genius the way she is and had great grades and good athletics because she wanted to impress her brother so that her brother would, you know, dote on her. And at some point they grew apart, mainly because he became a neet and just got focused on Aroga games. And then the other aspect is just learning the ins and outs of being a female and does he like it or not, I guess is the main key thing there. But yeah, so over time meeting Mihari's, his sister's friend, Kaede, who's like just a massive gyaru, massive big sister type. Kaede's sister, who's very boyish. And then the other two friends of Momoji, who is Asahi and Mio, which is a Genki girl and a Fujoshi. Not technically Fujoshi, she's
weird
an Iyuri.
Fujoshi type.
She's an Iyuri, yeah. Is it? Yeah, I guess it's still technically the term is still Fujoshi because it's this rotten girl, but does Fujoshi typically cover Yuri? You usually use Fujoshi when they talk about Yaoi. But I think it's still Rotten Girl because it's a girl that has a very taboo type like, which is the same gender kind of thing. I don't know.
It might be more in the category of what they, Watamote, the name that Watamote used was like Majo or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It had something to do with, it was similar to Fujoshi, but it was more along the lines of kind of the neat-ish where they go down a path that is just completely perverted type thing.
Yeah, yeah. So, Chris, finally, I get to hear your thoughts. Please don't tell me you hated Oni Mai. I boosted it too much, and Chris is like, this isn't as good as he was making it out to be, and then he hates the whole thing.
It wasn't. I definitely did not hate it. I actually really, really did love it. It was a very sweet show. Had a lot of absolutely adorable undertones that it just like Andrew had mentioned, the sister going through a lot of the troubles that she was doing to get her big brother to dote on her. There was those things like when she was Mahiro gets to talking to, I think it was Kaede, that he was talking about the fact that his sister was great in sports, great in academics, and just all around just was a fantastic character at everything she put her mind to. And during a one section, they were talking about these cookies that that the class was getting ready to do. And it all encapsulates in this one moment.
Oh, you mean that one where they have to keep Mio in check the entire
time? Yeah, they had to keep Mio in check. It all encapsulated in this one kind of moment where there's this Kaede really kind of impresses on Mahiro that it's very, very important that you make the cookies with
the best ingredients.
Yeah, the best ingredients.
Well, not just that, the
luck.
Fact that Mihari went to Kaede to learn how to cook from her
exactly.
Because she wanted to do something great for her brother.
And that was my point, is that it all encapsulates in this one moment where they're talking about the most important ingredient is love. And then he hands off these cookies to Mihari. And says, I made these for you. They're not as good as yours. And this entire moment kind of encapsulates. Yes, it had this fantastic payoff of Mihari crying her eyes out.
And
then finally, when she eats it, she says, Oishi. And there's just this kind of release of all that emotional tension of this was the moment where – because he even noted that she likes black tea and he put black tea in the cookies to make, made me kind of want to figure out how to make these black tea cookies. but no, it was really a fantastic encapsulating of this is what this show is it really does build up this emotional, drama point that it wants to drive home, and it's really fantastic about how it does this. And I give this show all kinds of credit, and it is one of those. Yeah, Andrew, you were right. It was a really good show,
but I didn't get a. I love this show at the beginning, so
I'm upset. Sorry. I love this show.
Yeah, we got it, boys. We got it. I literally had the entire Discord working against Chris because of his lack of watching this show. And at the same time, it's like, I almost feel bad because I'm like, I know he doesn't have much time, but he could squeeze this in somewhere. Come on. Squeeze it in somewhere.
Okay. And just so y'all know, all the shows that are up on this list that I was supposed to finish, i.e. Eminence of the Shadow, was because I put off for Onimai. Just so you guys all have it. And next week, when I have other shows that I'm supposed to be finishing, probably won't get finished because of the Revolution show that I'm supposed to be watching.
I like to remind people that he was still watching Chill in My 30s. He could have watched
Eminence
Shadows.
I was trying to catch up before the end of... I had, like, two more days. I tried. I didn't finish it. Did you see me finish it? No, I did
but
not finish
it. But you were watching it, though. The
I was trying
you
to.
You could have watched it.
Are you watching Chilling in My 30s?
Hell no.
Okay, somebody's got to cover
for time.
It.
It's for the fact that show is garbo. That show is garbo. Anyways.
It's not as bad as you think it is.
It is totally bad. It is. I have heard nobody besides Chris say it's good, and I don't trust
I didn't say
Chris's
it was good.
Judgment.
I did not say it was good. I said it's not garbo.
I like watching the other shows that it's borrowing things from rather than watching the show that borrows everything. Anyways, Onimai. God, where do I start? I've made so many videos on this, so people are probably sick of hearing me talk about this. But again, this is mostly for the podcasters, because our podcasters are fantastic, and I want to make sure that we get everything across to them. Onimai is very, very special and multiple levels. I think at the core thing, it's Bind. It's the team that worked on the show that made it as incredible as it is. Despite the controversies, how, oh my gosh, Mahiro is super petite and it is questionable in certain regards. I don't think it goes too far. I think the OP is the most far it goes because it has different perspective shots of him, you know, in different outfits. I think that's as questionable as it gets. And I think even besides the fact that there's some people that are upset about the idea of the sister drugging her brother, in the core, there is a really great story here, and it only exists because of the team behind it. It's because of Studio Bind. It's because of the animators. It's because Michiko Yokote, who's incredible at series composition. The more special thing here is having Akio Watanabe involved with the storyboarding. This is a character designer. Akio Watanabe, of course, for those who don't know, did the Monogatari, is a character designer for things like Monogatari series. He's an incredible artist. And I think they know expressions, they know characters, they know how to make them come to life. So mixing them with a passionate group of animators that had been working on this project for a year out before it even came out is what made it what it is. And I think even more so the directing and the series composition in the idea that this isn't the manga. I read the manga alongside this show, and it's not the manga. Bind, this team, made an anime. They didn't adapt a manga, they made an anime. Because it doesn't play out like the manga. The manga has the punchlines. The manga has the core concepts. But they're always to build to a punchline. It's just introduce scene, present joke, nail joke. Next scene. They actually took it and they took the core concepts and they made it into a story. That's the key thing. They made a story here of, again, of a character, of a brother who has disconnected himself from a sister who loves her brother and fears for her brother. And even he admits at some point, I have nothing. I'm useless. I might as well be useful to my sister. She's good. She succeeded. If I can help her with her experiments, then I'll be useful to somebody. He even himself acknowledges that what he's doing right now is just nothing. He's this home security system. And I think because of what Bind did with it, there was even this one moment where they had this onsen segment. It's pretty early in the manga, and it completely skipped it. And I was like, no, that's one of the coolest parts of the manga. I mean, there's not many like, oh my gosh, moments in the manga, but that was kind of one of those, whoa, this is so cool. And I thought they were going to skip it, but they actually did it. And it worked perfectly where they put it. Again,
that was that was the one that I was talking about that I got out of order. I technically got it way early.
Oops.
Oops.
Oops. There's an onsen episode. Oops. But no, it all worked out perfectly. And like I said, it all kind of culminates to this core idea that I think what they did here was they elevated the source material and they made something in itself that is truly special. And again, it has a great mixture. The comedy's fantastic. The elements of the heart between the siblings. It's the elements of the questioning and enjoying something that you don't think you'd enjoy. I've made many arguments that yes, the initial trigger is one of those, oh my gosh, I can't believe she did this. But what it turned into was something special. I've always said ever since Studio Bind first announced Onimai that they're a studio about adapting uncomfortable truths. And the uncomfortable truth here is the idea of a boy becoming a girl and all the things that come with it. Yes, even that time of the month, all those kind of things. And what was great about it is that it never really sat in this stuff. So I don't really feel like it's inappropriate in any ways, but I can see people being uncomfortable with certain aspects of it. But what came from it is exploring those things in a way that I thought was really thoughtful. And I love how he gets caught up in it all the time. He's dancing in front of a mirror in a cute, frilly outfit. And then his sister catches him and he goes, dang it, what am I doing? I'm not supposed to like this. He loves it. And he likes these new things he's encountered. He loves his new friends that all have heart. He's realizing very quickly, not that what he was is bad. It's not saying that Nitam and what he liked before, visual novels and stuff is bad. It's just him going, here's this other possibility. And you know what? I kind of like it. I like what I'm getting into. And it's that question mark that is ultimately the concept of the story. And I loved how they nailed it. Sorry, what?
It wasn't that big a deal.
I wanted to finish my point. No, I'm going to get another point. But no, all the characters are fantastic. I love them. Even Mio. I hate Fujoshi characters. I really do. And when Mio first showed up and she started doing the whole, like, drooling at the spectacle of Momiji and Mahiro and Asahi, I was like, oh god, not this character. And then eventually
I got such a kick out of when they were in front of the R18 room and she was like, I kind of like these, but don't tell anybody. It's like, she's like, everybody already knows. They had already hinted at it a couple times.
This is like, yeah, we all knew that. That's the whole skit thing where he slaps at him. I ended up liking her. And I think a lot of that has to do with how Bind adapted her story and how she's technically like something that's taboo and how Mahiro kind of pushes at her, you know, like what you like kind of thing. It was a really sweet little scene. I love Momiji. Super cute, super pure. Asahi is super pure. Asahi is the one that just doesn't know anything, super oblivious, even when they're talking about, you know, Sensei, Mahiro is, you know, dealing with that right now. I don't think she should be out here. And then Asahi's like, what is she talking about? And they're like, you'll learn later, girl. It's so cute how it kind of presents these things. Well, and like I said, when Kaede showed up, was similar to Mio. Oh, here's the Gyaru girl. She's going to be super promiscuous. No, she's the big sister, and she's super, super full of heart. The scene in the theater was like, which, by the way, was funny, the whole Galactic Titanic version with Leonardo DiCaprio and stuff. But no, like him obviously putting off going to the restroom for too long and then realized, okay, that's a little bit different for me and as an accident. And then Kaede shows up and just goes, I'll keep it a secret. We'll clean this up. Don't worry about it. Oh my gosh, I love this girl.
Didn't they name the Leonardo character actually Leonardo?
I think it was. But yeah, it was like, it's different in the manga, but yeah, they went with the Titanic thing, which was perfect. Like, it was so great. Which totally makes sense to why he would be trying to hold it and eventually have an accident because that stupid movie was too long. I wonder if that was part of the joke, was like, they knew that Titanic was a really long movie. But yeah, and yes, of course, Mihari, I freaking love her. I love her so much. Every time she would squee over him doing something for her, how much heart she has, how much she does for him and goes out of her way to make sure that he's comfortable and taking care of him. Yes, she caused a lot of his problems, but she's there and she's attentive and she's taking care of him. She freaks out whenever there's something wrong. Like, again, when that moment happens, she starts freaking out. Like, she literally is devastated. And I think Mahiro was surprisingly good as well. I really thought that, okay, he likes Ero stuff. He's going to be super perverted. No, he really kind of adapts to what and again, it brings up that whole question mark of how much of him is really changing. And it kind of expresses that a little bit in the idea that at some point he starts watching BL. And he's like, I don't like the fact that I actually am attracted to this. It's because he's sort of changing in a lot of his regards. So he's not superly overly pervy around the other characters, which are obviously under his age now that he's more petite and he's going to middle school again. He's really kind of respectful about it. Yes, it happens, but he's not like super pervy. And he turns out to be a really cute character that you can sort of believe him becoming a girl because it plays it out so well. Anime, I'm sorry. If there's probably a lot of source material out there that works better or manga and stuff that works better. But typically what I've seen in anime, gender bin-wise, suck. They all suck because they get the initial punchline, they get really pervy about it, and then it gets boring after a while. This one just nailed it and did it so well. And again, I think that's massively because of the team behind it. I cannot express enough. Watch this show. It's my number one of the season and probably easily an anime of the year contender, and it may end up being my anime of the year because of not just what it is, but what they built here, which I think is absolutely, like I said, something you never see. Typically, it's panel by panel adaptation. Typically, it's just kind of throwing things together to make an animated format. This one was incredible. The music, the animation, the characters, the style, everything. 10 out of 10 show for me. I love it to death. Highly suggest it. Unfortunately, global version sucked. It wasn't that bad. The global version wasn't that bad, but there is technically a lot of censorship in the global version that Crunchyroll has. It's not Crunchyroll censoring it. I hate hearing that. Pretty much anywhere outside of Japan was this one global version, and that was the unfortunate thing, but that's what the studio decided. I watched the other version.
Yeah, going on to what Andrew was mentioning about the fact that it didn't, him being a neat and everything like that, it didn't really wallow in it. Like, in a lot of cases you see, there's only a few shows that has actually pulled this off. It's really hard to balance the idea of, hey, this is a character that is technically a pervert, blah, 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 neat, hikimori, whatever you want to say. But this one does it really well in the fact that what it'll do is it'll usually, when he wants to fall back into his old habits, he goes over to his computer and he starts playing his game or something like that. But then he quickly gets bored of it very fast.
Or his sister tells him that if you do what she thinks you're going to do, she's going to end up blowing your brain because the women have like higher sensitivity when it happens or something like that. He's like afraid of it.
It's things like that that just kind of make a nod to the fact that he has that in his past, but doesn't wallow in it. Doesn't take the time to sit there and go, oh, well, he's a neat and he's going to be a neat and he's always going to be a neat. Instead, it goes, like Andrew was saying, makes mention of that thing. Later on, when he's trying to go outside, his sister is pushing him outside. He does go through with the process of going outside, but when it comes down to it, it's not sitting there wallowing in the fact that, oh, he can't be outside because, and then turn it into this 5-minute fiasco of him just completely complaining over and over and over and over again about how he's outside and he's not supposed to be outside. It just takes the time to make mention of it, say that this is a problem, but moves on from that and gets into the other story beats. But yeah, I love the way they handled a lot of things, especially like the uncomfortable truths. Andrew, every time Andrew mentioned it, I kept wanting to talk about it because was that time and I love the fact
that it's a really easy way to get out of PE. It's like, yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, well, that was what I was again, getting ready to point. I
realize it, and then she kind of stamps it out a little bit.
In a way, it is one of those cool things that. I know that I had thought about it. I talked to somebody when I was in school about that is how would anybody know that the girl is having that time? You wouldn't. You just have to go off of her word. What if she does it several times in a week? I mean, and she kind of
send her to the doctor.
Yeah. The sister mentions you don't want to take advantage of that. And it's like, that's very true because everybody knows that this is not a constant thing and you don't want to take advantage of it. Otherwise, when you do have that problem, you're not going to be able to do it.
That's what she was saying. Yeah. You're going to eventually have it and they're not going to listen to the girl who cried wolf, basically. Yeah. I like the fact that he's like, that was like a really bad experience. Like, he's like, this kind of sucks. He's like, I give women a lot of credit for having to deal with this. And then he's like, you know, if you ever have this problem, let me know so I can take care of you. And she just immediately freaks out, like, don't you dare. Like, because it's embarrassing to her, but yet she wants him to not be embarrassed by the fact. It's like, whenever he's kind of showing that affection of, like, I realize how bad this is. Let me help you next time. Like, he's genuine, like, this is a really bad thing. It kind of sucks. Let me help you out with it. And she completely gets it flustered because she doesn't want her brother to know when she's doing that because she got him to open up, but she doesn't want to open up. It's super cute. I'm going to get back into it. I'm going to move on. I love this show so much. It's so fantastic. The boys. I love the boys. I felt so bad for the boys. But, man, he got them locked down, like, massive. It was kind of funny because, like, early on, it's like, my kin. Let's talk about a game. I can talk to these boys. And they're just freaking out, like, what is this cute girl talking to us? What's going on, you know? And then they get in trouble by the other girls because he starts freaking out when they make this one comment. But then it kind of, over time, transitioned to him, like, getting into makeup and stuff. And then it completely grabs them, and they're bringing her chocolates and stuff. And then he's like, that's it? Is there more? I'm like, oh, dang, girl. You're turning into that. It's so great. I love this show. I cannot wait for the Blu-ray of it. I want a second season. I wish that Bayan had announced another season quickly. They did sort of hint when they were in the train. It said, next stop, Onimai. Next stop, Onimai. And then they were in the second carriage. So off the side, it says Onimai in the digital display. And then off the side, it shows a number 2. And I'm like, it's a stretch. But I'm not going to accept that that's a proof that it's coming. Because they should have announced it by now. But I do want more. And there's enough for another season, so I hope. I want more. Anyways, that's Onimai. I'm Now Your Sister. Please go watch it. It's amazing. It's fantastic. I love it. I want more. But yeah, anyways, moving on. As soon as my mouse actually works. There it goes. Malevolent Spirits Mononogatari. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes. It is essentially in a world where you have these Tsukumagami, which for those who don't know, they're basically where an object can essentially be possessed by spirit, and the spirit can then in this world kind of manifest into a human and move amongst the humans themselves. And there's kind of groups that will go out and find these Tsukumagamis and reseal them away. And Hyoma is one of those. He's our main character. We kind of find out in his past he witnessed his two siblings be pretty much decimated and killed by an umbrella Tsukumagami. And so he kind of vows from that point on to train and to not trust any Tsukumagami, beat the crap out of them, steal them away because they can all possibly be dangerous like that umbrella one. And he's also trying to find the umbrella one to destroy it. Same time, his master kind of notes the fact that he's kind of very rough around Tsukumagami, so he wants to teach him that not all Tsukumagami are bad. So he ends up kind of shipping him off to this Botan Nakatsuki, who is special in her own right, but she's living with six Tsukumagami. And they're like family to her, so she's kind of the exact opposite. Hyoma hates all Tsukumagami, Botan loves Tsukumagami. So living with her obviously would help him see that not all of them are bad. The deeper aspect is why Botan is special, why she is being protected, and what her whole story is kind of what they get into as the story goes along. But I'm not really going to get into all that stuff. You can watch it yourself. But yeah, he has kind of early on gained the... He screws up. He says something he shouldn't have because he's kind of dumb. He's kind of dumb around girls and relationships and talking to people. So he says something really stupid. And that gets all the Tsukumagami angry. And he sort of puts a challenge upon himself that he has to gain the signature of each one of these Tsukumagami in order to stay there. Otherwise, he will get kicked out of the house. And thus, he will no longer be able to be one of these hunters of the Tsukumagami. So, yeah, that's kind of the concept opening up. I would have to say this is kind of one of those shows where it's got a decent startup. Like, I do like the concept of the Tsukumagamis. I do have a little bit of a fatigue around the whole concept of Tsukumagami and technically yokai and whatnot in anime. So I'm always kind of looking for a different spin on it. And this is sort of like one of those cases of taking the concept of Tsukumagami and yokai and sort of tying it in with a shonen. And I didn't really have that feeling early on. I thought it was a great introduction of the characters. I liked all the Tsukumagami that were around Botan. Botan was okay. She was a little bit distant, but there's a reason why. And the idea of taking down the Tsukumagami, the idea that some being bad, some being good, was a decent startup. I think it's just one of those series where it kind of presents the core driving force for the main character, introduces the characters that will be around them, and then insert bad guy. And it didn't really have the feeling early on, except for the driving force being introduced so early. But as it went along, probably about halfway through this core or this season, it started having that feeling of, oh yeah, this is a shonen. Like, it just at some point it just jumps out and says, by the way, this is a shonen, and here's the factions, here's the main core storyline, here's the driving force for the character, and get stronger, basically. Get stronger because you have to face something even stronger. And that's where it kind of gives me a little hesitation. This is similar to Bungo Stray Dogs in that they already announced the second season. It will be in July. And I think I'm going to have a better idea of the overall story once that second season comes out. Because what I've gotten so far is decent animation. Surprisingly decent animation with the action scenes and stuff like that. Okay characters. I don't necessarily like Hyoma because he's a little bit too dense. Like, he is the type that when somebody says something that's obviously pointed, he will go, holy crap. He'll walk away and everybody thinks that he's bothered by it, but then they'll end up running into him later and he'll be like, no, it was this something else jumped in his mind, so he's focused on this thing. And it's like, do we have to use that joke every time something really serious comes up? Does he have to run off and then everybody thinks he's upset, but then he's not? That sort of is a nag in there. But everything else, it's like, it's sort of, like I said before, it is a shonen type setup. It's a shonen type of formula, but every little ingredient is kind of done a little better than most shonens. So it is definitely one of those series where if you are looking for a decent shonen with the Tsukumagami concept in it, it's definitely worth a watch. I was very surprised about how much I enjoyed watching every single episode. And the only really nagging thing in there is that feeling of fatigue around the shonen concept and the shonen formula, but it still managed to keep my attention because it was just a step above everybody else. So it does have me kind of excited where it can go from here. It sort of indicates they might get into the Umbrella Tsukumagami earlier than I thought they would, based on the teaser at the end. But who knows? We'll have to wait and see. It would be a huge shock for me if they just immediately stamp that whole thing down. That's typically for these shonen shows. It's the driving force their entire life until the last volume when they finally go up against the thing. Or it could be one of those things where he quickly runs into it but then gets stamped down. Who knows?
Or he could become best friends with the Umbrella and there's somebody else worse than that.
Are we going to do that one? Anyways, it's a solid watch. I enjoyed it. It's got a good cast of characters. The chemistry is really solid. There was only a couple parts where it was like, okay, the writing here is really dumb. Like, they had this one grinding, herb grinding Tsukumagami, and like, just hearing Botan's name, it literally killed somebody. But since they were a Tsukumagami and a type of Tsukumagami, they didn't die. And it was like one of those moments of like, okay, immediately seal this girl. But they're like, no, it's fine. It's fine. I'm like, no, she literally, if that was a normal human, she would have killed that human over a name. Seal her away. But other than that, it was fine. So, yeah. I suggest it if you're looking for that type of show. If not, then, pass kind of thing. So, yeah. Not doing enough refreshing to warrant it. So, Malevolent Spirits, check that out if that's interesting to you. Saving 80,000 gold for In Another World for my retirement. This one streamed on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Felix Film, based on a light novel. And this one opens up with a girl named, or not a girl, it's technically, she's an adult. She says that. She's an adult. She's an adult. An adult named Mitsuha. Just budding adult. She just became an adult. Mitsuha, who apparently having an argument on this cliffside on the beach, and this guy just kicked her off the side of the cliff. And as she's falling to her death, she's screaming how much it sucks. And she's reaching out to grab at something, and she ends up grabbing something that screams out. But then she teleports into another world, kind of a medieval fantasy world. And she's like, doesn't really know what happens. She ends up going to a nearby village, doesn't know anything that anybody there is saying, but she kind of stays there for a little bit. Eventually has a dream, or at least kind of has a conversation with this object, this thing. And this thing says that it's not a god or anything, it's just it is this object that accumulated enough energy that eventually it was able to pass to different dimensions. And yeah, the thing that she grabbed was part of its energy, and it has infused inside of her brain. And it says that it can't take that power back from her because it would kill her. So she's like, yeah, that would be, let's not do that. But he's like, you know, look, now you have the power to transport between dimensions, and your body regenerates really fast too, and you want something else? And she's like, oh yeah, can I have the ability to understand all languages? And he's like, yeah, sure, here you go. And then just pieces out and leaves. So what kind of comes from here is that Mitsuha, knowing that she can transport between these two worlds, she ends up saving this girl from these wolves and ends up getting paid for it. And she realizes the currency is gold. So she's like, okay, well, I can get currency for gold here. Gold's worth a lot back in my home world. So if I can just kind of bring things from my world, anything that she touches, she can transport between the two worlds. And she can only transport to places that she can see. So she's transporting between these two worlds, and so she'll bring stuff from our world to there, sell it, get gold, bring it back to our world, and then have a mercenary group that she ends up finding convert it into, you know, a currency in our world, all, like the title leads you to believe, all to gain 80,000 gold for her retirement. That's her idea. And so she goes about that task, you know, meeting the nobles, eventually opening up a shop inside of the central kingdom, meeting a bunch of people, and so on and so forth. And like I said, all while kind of transporting back to our world to do, you know, deals with this mercenary group that's giving her guidance, protection, and, yes, showing her how to use weapons because she doesn't have OP abilities, so she needs to carry a piece. So, your thoughts on easily one of the most surprisingly joyful shows of the season?
It is an absolute treat. Mitsuha is an absolute spitfire. I love her conniving nature. She just has this kind of, it's brilliantly thought out. One of the goofy things, as you watch through a lot of different isekais, a lot of the characters are kind of, okay, I'll just go with it. This one, she's actually really, when I say Spitfire, I mean, she literally is trying to figure out ways to bring the situation under her control in and trying to manipulate people into doing things that she wants to do. And she's not afraid to just do what she's going to do and
sell her ponzu.
Sell the ponzu. Exactly.
why not?
Didn't she end up in a situation where somebody else asked her and she was like, you're not having that. And I was like, wait, you were willing to sell it earlier.
Cause she's wearing them.
I really did enjoy watching the show. Just the goofball nature of the world that she's involved in, her conniving nature, the kind of house situations became more and more absurd as time went on, right down to an actual battle between, let's just say, a very, very large animal and a very, very powerful weapon. It's all here. Just everything wrapped up into one absolutely fantastic outfit that she was wearing at the end that I absolutely loved. And she looked fantastic in.
Might I add, a not CGI large monster. Can we at least acknowledge that? Whenever it's so sad that I got to the point whenever it's not CGI'd, I'm like, can we say amazing? Even if it's not animated a lot, at least it's not CGI. Like, man, what was that? The Omiyoji Exorcist reincarnation this season met the dragon in that one. Oof. Woof. My thoughts on Saving 80,000 Gold, Mitsuha. It's literally the Mitsuha show. I love Mitsuha. I love Mitsuha. Did I mention that I love Mitsuha? She's amazing. I love her. She's literally going to go down as one of my favorite female protagonist characters in all of anime. I just love her, everything about her. She's relatable. I agree with everything she does. It makes sense what she does. She basically breathes a very refreshing life into a very typical isekai. In the genre of isekai. And the idea that when she's presented with this option of being able to go between the worlds, she makes a decision, and I'm like, I would do the same thing. Like, it makes perfect sense what she's doing. And then being that she doesn't have, like, amazing OP abilities, all she can do is regenerate or heal quickly. But she doesn't have, like, a super hyper beam. She doesn't have massive OP magic. So she's like, I need a way to protect myself. So obviously I'm going to go figure out how to shoot so I can be able to protect myself. And of course, everybody that witnesses it thinks that she's the caller of the thunder or something like that. Caller of lightning or thunder or something like
messenger that. Messenger of
lightning. Yeah, the messenger. I just love her to death. Now, I think the only thing that really kind of bogs down this series is the fact that she's really the only character I like. Like, I don't really... There wasn't... Maybe Sabine. I liked her, the princess. She was a lot of fun. But for the most part, the supporting cast of the show isn't really there. They don't spend enough time with them.
It's funny.
It's fine for me because Mitsuha is such a great character. And she sets the focus that it makes it okay. I did like that brief moment of, like, familial bond that sort of hits her out of nowhere with a certain group. Like, it just... And it got me off guard. Like, it was like, this is such a goofy show. I love her. She's so infectious. And then suddenly out of nowhere, she's crying. I'm like, oh, it hurts. Like, where did this come from? This is supposed to be a fun show. And suddenly she realizes, oh, yeah, I'm alone. And I sort of feel like this is my family right now, which is really good.
It's actually really funny because Andrew... pointing that out, it is something that I would kind of echo in a way. It is weird that in a lot of cases when we point out something in a show where we go, this character doesn't really work for me, but the rest of the cast really does, but this is the main character, and so it's really hard to follow the show because we have to deal with this main character. This is literally almost exactly the opposite, where I'm fine with all the other characters, but none of them really stand out as a character that I can go, oh yeah, that I really, really
like
that. Well,
it was like the brother. I thought the brother would be like a central focus. Because she early on, she like whenever she thinks about things, she always asks her brother that's in her mind. Because she lost her whole family. And she keeps thinking about her brother because her brother was like a taku slash prepper, like anything otaku. Because for those who don't know, otaku isn't anime centric. It's otaku in Japan is an obsession with something. It is a hobby that you take really seriously. And he was basically an otaku of everything. He did planting. He was all into like medieval times. He was into games. He was into military, all this stuff. And so whenever she had like a decision to make, it would always pop into her head. She'd have this conversation with her brother. And it did it quite often early on, but at some point it just didn't really do it anymore.
Yeah, it pops. So it would pop up maybe once an episode at most. It really did slow down on the brother, but yeah,
which doesn't hurt me.
And he was the one that
I was
okay
with it.
He was the one that I was really more afraid of than anything because like I was mentioning, we always have that one character that bugs the crap out of us, and I was really scared that he was going to end up being that for the show. This character that you just really, really hate when they pop up on the screen. But
usually because he was always over-explaining things. Like, it was like, okay, well, here's this thing that we're dealing with. And suddenly he would pop up. And it was so hilarious that at some point, I think she was with the Adventurers. And she started thinking about something. And then it was like a decision they were making. That's right. She was talking about how she could possibly sell things to a group. And then suddenly out of nowhere, he pops up and says, that might be dangerous because if you make a deal with them, it could drop. And then suddenly she just cuts it off and says, we'll deal with the repercussions later. I'm like, just totally cut him off because she knew like we did. Whatever. Don't care. It was just – I watched it like 3 times because I just laughed out loud how she just completely was like, no, we're not. That's all right. It's fine. I don't care, brother. It was kind of heartbreaking, too, if you think about it. Just telling her brother to shut up. Listen to your poor dead brother. Come on. But no, I through and through, this show was really special. And I, like I said before, I fully acknowledge it's Mitsuha. And it could be one of those ones where somebody else could watch this show and probably not feel like Mitsuha is that special. And you probably will drop off of it. But I think she's just a refreshing main character. The focus of the show isn't for her to get a harem. It's not to have a reverse harem. It's not for everybody to love her because she's a waifu character in reverse. It is kind of one of those shows where it's very respectful of her. She's grown up. She's tackling this process. She's focused. She's conniving. She's not willing. She's not conniving in a bad way because she's focused on what she wants to do, and she's going to drive to get that. She's very business-centric. She always tried to kind of rope things around to make money. But she's never willing to overlook people in trouble. Like when this girl gets kidnapped, she's going to chase him down and, take out the beast. She's willing to do things whenever people are in trouble, but at the same time, it's always to make a benefit if she can. And I like how it kind of presents that. Her joy is infectious. Her conniving is infectious. Every scene is great because of Mitsuha. And I think that's what makes this show so special for me is... I even like the fact that she's not, like, sexualized or anything, because the moment that they actually have her in something that's revealing, the adventurers notice it, and you notice it too, because, like, well, wait, she's wearing a bikini. She's sewing skin, finally.
She's
more style, and I love that. I love style versus, overly sexualizing. Like, the ED is nothing but outfits, and it's got great style to it.
She is absolutely the perfect... It's so funny because Andrew bringing up that she's not a waifu. She is the perfect waifu because of the fact that she is literally not sexualized or anything like that. And at some point, if they do that, any fan service, it's going to pay off like a millionfold. It's literally because of the fact that they built her up in such a certain way that she will be, she is actually the type of character, like I said, I mean, when I had mentioned it was all wrapped up in this one outfit, I thought that outfit that she finalized out in the last couple of episodes was absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah.
And it was such a, it's literally the most, for lack of a better term, conservative outfit that she wears through the entire show, but it was beautiful on her.
It's style,
just like Andrew is saying. That's the thing, is they turned her into literally a perfect waifu.
She's
not even trying to.
She's style over skin, really, is what it is. So, yeah, I love it to death. That was, I would say, the only thing that you could probably pull out of me that was negative, besides the fact that, like I said, the most brother. Of the side characters... I don't mind the brother. Most of the side characters are kind of
that's the most negative. I mean, if and I just said he's not that bad.
Yeah. I think besides the fact that I think a lot of the side characters are kind of just there to accent Mitsuha, which is a good thing. You can do that. A writer can do that, and it works fine. Mitsuha is a focus. All the side characters are to play into her. The only thing that I thought that was kind of annoying was that they... Not a lot, but there was a few times where they repeated the same kind of concept. Somebody would come to her shop or something that she's working on and threaten to destroy it. And then for some reason, by some happenstance, somebody really important would show up and shut down the situation. So this guy from the guild is trying to shut down or buy out her shop. And then randomly, like literally the king's right-hand man walks the door. And then you'd have this other kind of, she's working on this restaurant. And then randomly, the king himself walks the door. And it's like, it's always like this, just so happens somebody's in the neighborhood walks the door whenever she's in trouble. And most of the time, she handles the situation herself. But I felt like they reused that joke a little bit too many times. I would say probably like 3 times too many. But that was probably the only thing that was kind of a, eh. And yes, it's not the most beautiful show. This isn't like crazy animation here. It was just enough to keep it going. There was a few points off model. Yes, a lot of CGI vehicles and stuff, but for the most part, it was decently animated. Whenever it needed it, it was on Mitsuha and it worked. So I highly suggest it. It was a huge surprise for me. There was a couple people that ended up watching it at my recommendation. They enjoyed it. So like I said, you'll know within the first few episodes. If you like Mitsuha, if you love Mitsuha like we do, you'll enjoy the show. If Mitsuha is not really doing anything for you, maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if they do another season, if Andrew can keep with it, because it looks like they're going into town building. So
that'll work for me. If it's Mitsuha, like I said, sometimes it takes is a character. And I mean, that's like with the whole thing with Emiya family.
Technically, you got through the food cooking part. So maybe mm-hmm. you can handle a town building.
Yeah, they didn't get too deep in the cooking stuff, which is good. So. All right, moving on. We have High Card, streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio Hibari, a mixed media project. And yes, we already have another season already confirmed for it, or as I like to call it, Sionsen, because they misspelled it in the key art, which is funny. Anyways, High Card opens up in what is seemingly kind of like our modern times world itself. It's got like its own kingdom. It's this big kind of island that has these... I think 3 different kingdoms within it. At some point, right off the bat, we see that some group infiltrated this one facility and stole this briefcase. And the briefcase ends up getting blasted as they're trying to flee. And it's pretty much like Dragon Ball, like spread all these objects within it throughout this entire kingdom. These objects are different playing cards. Yes, like a deck. And each one of these cards, depending on the card itself, will have different abilities that can unlock if a quote-unquote player uses them. It, like, the card itself chooses who can use it, and when they're chosen, they can then use this card and its special abilities, and based on the number on the card itself is how powerful it is. And we follow a guy named Finn, who is living at this, or at least trying to support this orphanage that he grew up in. It's kind of like his home, and he's trying to figure out ways of making money. Eventually, he goes to gamble to get some more money and ends up running into this kind of mafia group that is trying to find the cards, while the kingdom itself has its own organization called High Card that's trying to collect all the cards for the king himself, because it's dangerous to the kingdom if people have these cards. And so Finn ends up getting dragged into the High Card group, which again kind of gets calls every now and then to go out to a location because they suspect somebody has one of these cards to retrieve the card. And over time, you sort of get a bigger hint about the organization itself and this mafia group that's trying to find all the cards itself, and just the relationship between Finn and his partner, Chris, as they go about collecting all the cards. So, yeah, surprisingly enjoyed this one, which is kind of odd. I mean, I really had no expectations coming into it. Honestly, I think a lot of to do with my enjoyment of this series was kind of the absurdity of the cards themselves and the magic that kind of comes with it. Now, early on, I think it was really incredible. Like, the first episode was really great because it sort of has this kind of play out of almost a chaoticness of having multiple abilities in presence. You had this guy that was that can turn things into marbles by touching it. You had this guy, Chris, who had the ability to pretty much regenerate himself or pretty much makes him immortal. You have Finn, who has like the weakest number card possible that is able to shoot straight, which is not that great, but still. You had this other character who pretty much becomes like a psychotic, like swords wielding chick. You have somebody that's able to make, you know, growing branches and stuff that can grab things and vines. The chaos of the first episode and going on the second episode was pretty solid. And I think it made it fun. It's like a fun action show. Now, I will admit that it sort of gets a little bit formulaic for quite a while as it tries to introduce different characters like Leo and gives, you know, Wendy an episode. For some reason, VJ never got an episode, which is kind of surprising. Each of the characters within Hidecar gets, like, their own little episode as they sort of sprinkle in the overall story between the organization, the kingdom, and the mafia group. And I think it kind of leads into a very chaotic later part of the series, especially trying to get into Finn and his backstory. But I will admit that it's not... It's kind of one of those shows where it's fun to watch. It feels very buddy cop in Finn and Chris's kind of relationship and how they handle situations is very fun. But, like, overall, it sort of has a dipping point, especially in the middle area. But I think what it sort of indicated to me is that when the show and the writers get chaotic with their abilities, it works. And it does it several times, enough that it's a very entertaining show to watch. Which has me sort of excited for the second season that it's going to have, hopefully getting deeper into that sort of chaoticness that they have with the writing, and maybe pull it off in its second. It's kind of like, I'm going right back to where what I said with the whole Spirit Chronicles, Mononogatari's, Malevolent Spirits. It's sort of like that, where it's like, I almost feel like I need the second season to really tell if this is going to pan out to be something that's really enjoyable. But I can for sure say that if you're looking for a fun action show with a supernatural twist to it, it's worth a watch. It's just at the same time, there's nothing really deep here to really kind of dig into, besides maybe how clever the writer is in sort of kind of breadcrumbing a twist. That's not, like, significant, but it's enough that made the first season kind of have a very satisfying end to it. And honestly, coming into the show, I had no expectations that it would have a satisfying, quote-unquote, twist to its ending, which made it satisfying. So, I said satisfying. Satisfying. But, yeah, definitely check it out. It's a pretty solid series. And like I said, if you're looking for a fun action show, it's definitely up there as one of my favorites. Not, like, you know, Cyberpunk levels here, but definitely enjoyable. So there's certain characters that need to be more present, though. That's the only unfortunate thing. But no, it was kind of funny, though, because we noted the fact that it was the Kakegurui writer and artist whatnot for Kakegurui, like Homura and Hikari, and they did Build Divide as well, which I don't know that we noted that, but still, another case here. So I didn't realize it until we got into Wendy, and I'm like, oh yeah, this is totally Kakegurui. All right. Thankfully, didn't have that type of stuff. But it gives you an idea of the pedigree. I mean, that's what Kakegurui is known for, is having those kind of twists in a game. And this sort of has that a little bit, but not enough, I think, as compared to Kakegurui. But still has that pedigree in it. So I recommend it in the end, so. Let's move on. Kaina of the Great Snow Sea. I don't even want to talk about this show. It was an 11-episode series. It's got a movie coming to kind of wrap up the story, but it's by the creator. What was his name? I forget. Sotomu Nihei, which, of course, is known for doing, like, Nice Sidonia and stuff like that. Appa Zims, those mangas. And, of course, his tie-in a lot with Polygon Pictures. It's the Polygon Picture title, so it's full CGI, doing a little bit of improvement in their animation, their style, honestly, but pretty much opens up in a world that is completely covered by snow, and people are trying to kind of scrape a living by living at the base of these gigantic trees that span from the snow itself, and a lot of these countries are kind of running out of resources. Well, on top of the canopy that's created by the top of these trees is other people that live on this canopy. And we follow a guy named Kaina that's up there, and he's living with some elderly people. pretty much every other village that's been on the canopy has died away because the water's running out up there as well. And so you kind of have two different perspectives, the canopy people who are running out of resources and dying away, and then you have the people that are on the snow that are running out of resources and dying away, and the two don't think the others exist. Well, eventually this Liliha, which is from the snow area, decides to take like this creature's ballooning type self to go up to the canopy to find this sage that her mother told her about that will, you know, give them what they need to have all the resources they want. This sage that left the people. And so she gets up there, meets Kaina. He tells him, no, there ain't no sage up here. Sorry. Let me escort you back down the tree. And then that's when he kind of gets swept up in this war that's happening between all these towns over resources. Mainly, there's this one group that's going around and just dominating all the different trees in order to steal their resources. So, yeah, all for the hope of finding that sage that will save them all. I love Nihei's work. I love Blamu. I love Nice Sidonia. I liked Apozim's. And so I had an expectation coming into this, and I think it's definitely Nihei's work. Nihei is really well known for just, or at least for me, of creating sort of a lost culture that is being rediscovered, so to speak. Having this starting point that is after everything sort of has melted down seemingly, and then sort of slowly uncovering the truth of what's underneath your feet. And I think it has that sense here where it's like, okay, why is the planet covered in the snow that seems like it's water? And why do people sink to the bottom? Like there's no buoyancy whatsoever. And where is these resources? Who's the sage? All that kind of stuff. Why is there an emphasis on him knowing the signs of past culture? Unfortunately, at least for now, it could change in the movie. With 11 episode series, unfortunately didn't deliver. I felt a sense of intrigue the entire time, wanting to uncover the secrets, but they never really did much. And I think a huge part of that is beyond my enjoyment of the first four or so episodes, where it's just Liliha meeting Kaina, them talking about the canopy, the area below, meeting the civilizations. That was all interesting because I still had that sense of intrigue. But the moment they introduced the antagonist, everything went downhill, in my opinion. It kind of sprinkled something towards the later part where they discover something that could reveal some sort of way of everybody surviving. But everything in there in that later segment, not later segment, so like the entire middle part and the later part, is nothing but this other group that's just led by a cackling bad guy that just wants to see the world burn and steal everything from everybody and has zero depth to him whatsoever. No story whatsoever. I don't expect all bad guys to have meaning or purpose or understanding, but this guy was as plain bad guy as possible. And there was so much focus on him and his group. There was a little bit given to his quote unquote right-hand woman, Emeralte, but even then it wasn't enough. Even then, it was just kind of a product of previous destruction and not enough to really say, well, that was enjoyable or that significant. It's just now they're just trapped up in a war and it has very little substance to it. And it's where I can honestly say this is probably my first of Nihei's works that I'm just kind of like, woof, that didn't really do much. And again, the movie could change things. Hopefully we get the movie really quickly. I'm still going to watch it and I'm hoping that's where the punchline is. But again, for 3/4 of this particular season of Kaina, it felt like a waste. And that's really unfortunate. But I still like Polygon Pictures. I still like Nihei. But this is going to be my first flop for them, unfortunately. So that's Kaina. That's unfortunately Kaina. Sugar Apple Fairy Tale, did you watch this?
Nope.
Oh my gosh. Sugar Apple Fairy Tale ran on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by JC Staff. Pretty much opens up in a world where humans at some point, they were living side by side with the fairies. Everybody was happy. And then at some point, humans be humans. They figured out that they could enslave the fairies. All you really have to have is you just pluck one of their wings and you got control because you can keep that wing. Anytime you crush it, it will give. It pretty much is like crushing the heart of the fairy. Like, they are just put through massive pain. And at some point, we follow Anne Hofford, who her mother was a confectionist, a sugar confectionist. specifically sugars made by this processing of these sugar apples, and which was pretty much created by the fairies. And so her mother always told her, don't never look down on the fairies. They're what created this beautiful sugar that we make into confections. Cut forward, her mother dies, and she wants to become a confectionist so that she can make a confection and allow her mother to pass on, not worrying about her daughter. And so she goes off to the kingdom. On the way, she has to go through this dangerous area, so she buys a fairy from a dealer, and it's this chalet guy who's looks like he's a... He looks so pretty. He looks like a... what do you call him? Yeah, the person that would handle her personal needs, I guess is the best way to put it. But yeah, she hires him. He despises humans, obviously, because he's always been kind of treated like a, obviously, a slave by them. And she's like, you know, I want to be your friend. I don't want to have to command you. When we get to our destination, I'll give you your wing back and you could be free. But he doesn't trust her. Obviously, they don't trust each other because she won't give her the wing back now because she's in a dangerous area. Whereas he's like, you're a hypocrite because you have my wing. You don't want to be my friend. So they kind of have to learn to trust each other while at the same time. This is where I'm already wanting to get into it. Everybody in the world seems to be douchebags, and everybody's a dirtbag in this world. And, yeah, so they have to always worry about dangers that come from that. Semi-spoilers for, like, the second episode, maybe third episode. Her childhood friend, Jonas, shows up along her journey and steals her confection to run off to become a confection in her place because he's always, I guess, wanted to steal her stuff and claim rights to her creations. Anyways, yeah, so it's her fight to get resources and prove herself to the king and become a confectionist, all the while everybody seems to be coming up against her to pull away those resources or to sabotage her, or she tries to help a random noble of a country who's lost all hope in mankind, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, the only characters I like in this show is Ahn, Hallford, Chalet. I really do like their chemistry. I like the fact that at some point they really kind of meld that out. Because early on, I felt like they were going to go with that type of top-bottom relationship where he's like, if you want me to do something, command me like everybody else does. Like, she's just asking you. What's so wrong with her asking you to do it rather than commanding you? But he was very overbearing. And they chilled it out really well. Not that he became, like, a doting person suddenly, but he just kind of opened the door enough that he became a really solid character that I actually like to have on the screen. He's really cool. The art style in it is really gorgeous. Everything, visually-wise, is gorgeous. I love Ahn Hallford's design. I love all the character designs. I like, besides Jonas, I hate Jonas. The visual style itself, it looks very beautiful. All the backdrops and backgrounds are very kind of fairy tale art book type. And it has a really nice blend to it. Visually, gorgeous. And like I said, Ahn Hallford, Chalet, I love their chemistry. And I love, love, love Mithril de Tepato. Mithril de Tepato is literally the best character of the show. Yes, Rie Takahashi. But Mithril de Tepato is just super great. Just, you never know what he's actually doing. You don't know if he's being a bad guy, if he's being mischievous. He's a very unknown character. But at the same time, whenever something is going bad, he's always kind of there. And I love that. Love his character. But everybody else, and everything else about the show, I hate. I hate everything about this show other than those three characters. I despise the writer's obsession with Jonas as some sort of quote-unquote rival character. Everywhere she goes, Jonas is there for some reason. And it's so tiring that he keeps popping up and his character is terrible. And every other character in the show that she runs into is just cartoonishly villainous, and I can't stand it. It feels like the laws of this universe is all set to make Ahn Hallford's life terrible, and it makes no sense. It feels very lazy with the writing, all the drum up drama that just doesn't feel very well wrote. I loved it enough because of the chemistry of the main cast and Mithril, but I just rolled my eyes at every single person becoming a villain around her. And even characters that yet have not been revealed as being villainous, villains, I feel, is eventually going to be tricking Ahn Hallford. And that's where I struggle with. Like, I made a whole review video joking about every 2 seconds, my mind made me want to hate Ahn Hallford. And it's literally how I feel with this show, is that everything feels like it's rule set to hate her. And, like, even at the very end, when Anhoffer's chasing after somebody, at the very end, it's like everybody's getting in her way, and it almost feels like the universe is trying to stop her, and it just feels so comical. But like I said, while I'm not rolling my eyes at that, it's an enjoyable series. It's a very beautiful series, and I love Anhoffer. I think she's a great underdog story. It's just I hate that the underdog aspect is built on just everybody's mean. And besides who she... Anybody besides a fairy, an Anhoffer, is a terrible human being. And it's, it's comical in that regard.
What about Mom? Mom is bad, too?
She's dead.
Well, yeah, but she was obviously... She
could have been evil. We've never seen her.
I see. That's why she went and
she
died.
She probably spawned Jonas. We just don't know. Jonas is actually her brother. We just don't know it yet. She spawned that rotten disaster of a human being.
Yeah, I was going with she went and got killed because just to be mean to...
There you go. She's like, you know what would best destroy this daughter right now? Just end it. Codependency. I'll have her so codependent on me, and then I'll just end it.
Well, she didn't kill herself. She just
faked her death.
No, I would. Well,
she'll pop up later, and she's this cackling bad guy. I can see it. Anyways, that's Sugar Happle. Sugar. I wanted to say sugar happy. I had so many times where I recorded a video on it. And I'm like, I hope I didn't say sugar happy. I know I'm going to say it. But yeah, Sugar Apple Fairy Tale. It's got another season coming. I'm going to watch it. Hopefully the writing gets better, but I don't know. It will. Farming Life in Another World. This trash fire. This one was on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, done by Zero G. The source is a light novel, and it opens up with this guy who had a terrible life. He was sick, deathly sick in our modern times world, and the only thing he could do was sit in his bed and watch farming channels. And so when he finally dies, the god's like, yeah, we kind of screwed up. I want to make it better for you, so I'm gonna transport you to this other world. I'll let you have whatever decision you want. Okay, we'll give you a nice place by yourself. Do you want anything special? And he's like, well, I watched a bunch of farming things. I would like to try farming. And he's like, okay, well, I'll give you all the tools you need. You have this special tool that does everything you need. Take care. Have fun. And he ends up transporting him into this fantasy world in the middle of this dense, dangerous forest. Like the only place he could think of that's like isolated away from bad people. It's in the middle of literally the Demon King's realm in this monster-infested forest. But it was a mistake. So they still make mistakes. He pops up there. He starts going, okay, well, where's this tool? He pops out the tool, and it's literally a thing that whatever tool he wants, it becomes it. And so if it's an axe, it's like an incredibly OP axe. So all he has to do is like swipe once, and all the trees get knocked down. He's got a hoe that whenever he hits the ground, whatever he's thinking about wanting to grow... It literally it hits up the soil, it fertilizes it, and it puts the seeds in the ground. Like, he doesn't even have to get seeds or anything. He doesn't have to toil the soil for several years to fertilize it. It literally just happens. So I don't know how much farming he's actually doing, but he's doing farming. And he ends up, over time, kind of building a town. And seemingly every single female of the entire world comes to visit him and stays there, builds a massive harem, and starts trading with other kingdoms. The Demon King the entire time is terrified of him and trying to figure out what to do. And then every surrounding nation prods at him for a moment, then realizes that he's OP. Because, like, he can, like, create a spear that could just knock a dragon out of the air. Yeah, he's OP main character, OP farmer, and insert waifus. Your thoughts? Did you finish this one?
I think I got a couple of episodes left. I'm not sure. I did get very close to ending it. But, yeah... I did really like this show. I understand this is a simple concept, a simple storyline, very much just excuses to have a bunch of girls around him. And I think the most apt joke that Andrew made that is absolutely fitting to the show is this is Minecraft the anime. I mean, literally, dude just walks around
hits the ground a couple times, and voila, magical fruits come out of the ground.
I think it's sort of overselling it, because at least in Minecraft, you have to do some work. This guy literally does no work, but it has that same idea. Like, okay, now I need this resource. I'm going to dig into the ground. Oh, I missed the salt. And then she tells him where the salt is. And he's like, oh, there's a salt down inside the ground. It's kind of
and that simplicity just works for me. It really
yeah,
is.
Yeah, that's what I kind of argued is I'm like, I joke about the fact that he wanted to be a farmer. And so he's given this tool that literally makes to where he doesn't have to farm. So it's like, well, what farming is he doing? Like I said before, it takes a lot of effort to make... I mean, there's farmers probably listening to this that know how hard it is to make a fertilized soil that's cultivatable. It's a very long and arduous task. He's literally doing one hit. It's like, it's spit in the face to any farmer. But at the same time, would I want it to be more complicated? If you want a relaxing show, you don't want it to go into large detail about how he's got to toil it. He's got to get some, you know, fertilizing for it. He's got to go find seeds. Oh, let's travel for forever to find a village that has seeds already made out or whatever. So I understand why it's simple, but at the same time, it's sort of a spit in the face.
Yeah, and the most complicated that it probably got was towards the latter half. He started quote-unquote diplomatic ties with the surrounding villages. And I say that with the quote-unquote mostly because of the fact that a lot of it was, like Andrew had mentioned, all of the villages are effectively afraid of him. And so they're all sending out diplomats to kind of feel out his village and find out if he's aggressive or whatever have you. And it starts playing into this interesting tidbit of, should they write him off as a danger, or should they, you know, be aware of him and be careful of him and use him as this kind of wild card? So
he is dangerous because he's taking all their wives and children.
Yeah, right. He's taking all the women. But that's about as complicated as it gets. It doesn't really dig into any of those very heavily. It just kind of, send out a diplomat. The diplomat comes back. They point out that, oh, he's doing this, or there's all these dangerous things that are in that section, and what should we do about it? Oh, well, send him another girl.
I was going to say, then the diplomat doesn't come back.
Yeah, then the diplomat don't come back. But yeah, that's about as complicated as it gets. It works for me. I'm fine with it, and I enjoyed it.
I would say my positive is that if you're looking for a very laid-back, chill show, watch it. If you're just looking for just a basic show with tons of waifus, watch it. Now, my negatives is pretty much twofold. One is this is an extremely boring show for me. It wasn't doing anything for me, and that's mainly because it got into a formula of, like you said earlier, new group sees him, want to know if he's a threat, girl comes by, girl stays there, he has a new waifu. Insert, and it's like literally multiple times per episode, it's just open up situation where waifu shows up, waifu sees everything, says Sugoi, then stays, he has another wife. New waifu shows up, sees everything, goes Sugoi, stays, he has a new waifu. Next, it just... over and over and over and over for 12 whole episodes is introducing waifu. Waifu says Sugoi, stays there. And the only thing that was really breaking it up was every now and then seeing an outside nation going, oh my gosh, what is this? We should go check them out. He goes check them out. My gosh, resources. And they gave us stuff. They're cool. Moving on. And then waifu. It's just repetitive. It was so repetitive, and it didn't really give much time to really dig into any of these girls. Like, typically, I like these waifu shows because they get into the character and they actually have character development to them. Besides maybe the main couple that first start out, they don't really get into any of these characters. They just show up, they're introduced, they say Sugoi, and then they're the part of the group. Move on. And that's the sad thing. It's like, don't introduce another character until I know what this one's doing. I know that they look cute. There's more to these characters, I hope. The other aspect that really infuriated me,
the elves were super persecuted, and they have a drive for needing
man sauce.
Little girls or little kids and stuff,
yeah.
And And the dark like elves, or the elves, I'm sorry, like they're not times? Dark elves, they were mountain elves. They needed to have babies too. And it was super, super deep. And
plot.
Yeah.
Lots of plot.
Uh-huh.
Lots of plot. I think the spider got more development than anybody else.
The spider.
Actually had children and everything. But now my other problem that I have is like having this concept with the waifus and everything, being the core concept and... I got really angry towards later part because at some point somebody just randomly had an announcement and it made no sense to me because I'm like,
but I didn't know they were doing, I didn't even know they were doing something.
Yeah, right.
So
it's like, okay, so we're doing this. Are we not grown up enough to say that this is happening? And I'm hearing from a ton of people going either, no, they implied it here. I'm like, no, that wasn't implying. All anime say that we're going to live together. It doesn't end up in that way. I mean, Tonokawa still hasn't popped anything out.
The closest
problem
that
is,
they,
like, is
the
like, closest are we not they, grown up enough to just say this? Because everybody's saying in the source material, it says specifically he's doing this. And it's like, are we not grown up enough to say this is
so
what's happening?
It is in the source material?
Yes.
Because they
say that he's doing this with everybody. And it's like,
he's
why
doing it with
can't
everybody.
We say this? Yes.
The closest thing that they got with that particular character was that they had implied that there was a misunderstanding and that he was setting it straight that yes, he did actually want to be married to her. Yeah. That was as close to anything that I got out of that. And then suddenly, but it was also in such a way that it was like, okay, because he's being that way with pretty much every character in the entire group is like the way with the elves. I mean, I make the joke about it, but he keeps on going on about how the fact that I don't know how they're going to get their babies.
Dude. He's like, I guess you fixed your problem with not having a place to stay because they lost their homes. And he's like, I guess you still need to fix that other problem about, you know, doing that. And they're like, yeah. They're literally looking at him like, yeah. I know why they're doing it. And this is one of those core issues that I have. I can criticize Japanese anime. I am more than happy to criticize with how they do their material. And again, with the source material being very blatant about it, and them not doing it in the anime, tells me that they have an idol problem in Japan, where waifus and idols have to be untouched. And it's like they want to sell figures, they want to sell merch for these characters, so they don't want to imply that he's literally tarnishing them, quote-unquote. And it's so frustrating that we're not grown up enough to go, that's what's happening. Just tell me. Why is it a big deal? You're not going to sell much merch of this stupid show. It's not that popular. I'm sure it's going to sell plenty, and maybe they're thinking that what little they'll sell is going to be messed up by... just saying it. You don't have to show it. I know it's got to be on Japanese television too, so they're not going to show it, but at least say it or at least imply it in some way. And that's what frustrates me. And it made me so agitated with the show later on that I'm like, why is this happening? Why can you not be grown up enough to say it's happening? Instead, I'm confused as to... I just assumed that this girl was able to do it herself. Maybe she's that type. I don't know. Maybe it's a thing with vampires. I don't know. It's just, it's infuriating. But no, that aside, I was bored to begin with. It's just, again, just introducing waifus just to show them and then cultivating land and then showing people picking flowers and berries and stuff. I didn't get much out of this show, unfortunately. But like I said, if you're looking for just a chill show that you're, you know, not, I hate to say the term, turn off your brain type of show, it is technically that. Some people look for that kind of thing and that's what they kind of tag it as. And that's technically what I would say it probably is. So yeah, Farming Life. Check that out if that's what you're looking for. Revenger, not Revengers. I keep wanting to say Revengers because of Tokyo Revengers. Revenger, the series that aired on Crunchyroll, 12 episodes. Aijai Do worked on it. An original, yes, wrote by Jin Urobuchi, even though people want to claim that he just puts his names on things. This is one that he actually said that he was excited about doing, so he probably did write this one. Essentially, it opens up in kind of like a feudal Japan kind of thing, you know, at the later parts of Samurai, I think, but there's still Samurai that exist. We follow a character that is a Samurai named Raizo, and Raizo is sent by his boss to go take out somebody that is spreading drugs around, and he kills somebody under his orders, come to find out, oh, it was my fiance's dad that I just killed. And then he comes to find out, yeah, you were tricked. It was because his fiance's dad was discovering about the drug trafficking, and the boss wanted to get rid of him because he was figuring it out. Not that he was doing the drug trafficking. So he's kind of broken, kind of giving up on everything, and he ends up getting confronted by a guy named Yuen Usui. And Usui is a part of a group that is known as the Revenger. And Revenger is essentially a group that will get assigned to go enact revenge for somebody that cannot enact it themselves. So, like, one of the early examples they have is this lady ends up meeting this guy, and that guy ends up stealing all of her money and forces her into prostitution. And her pain and suffering is so great as she's dying that she's given a coin, a gold coin, and then she chews down on it. This is their sign of how much revenge they want. So this kind of the way that Usui explains it to Raizo, that they're not just, you know, hired hitmen. They are enacting revenge. And so he shows him, Raizo, one of these coins and shows how much biting strength you have to push into this coin to make this impression. That is what we're doing. It shows how badly they want revenge. And obviously being able to chew through a coin is going to hurt. It takes a lot of strength. So that's kind of their way of doing it. So they'll receive one of these coins, has a bite mark, they enact revenge. And Raizo, again, early on wasn't into it, but then he kind of realized this kind of aspect, sees these stories, sees the suffering of people, and helps them out with this. And so this little group of Revengers goes out and enacts these revenge stories. That's basically the setup. We'll, over time, kind of meet each one of the characters that are part of this group. Like, Usui, again, is the leader. He uses, like, gold paper to slap on people's faces, and it suffocates them before it scatters, because obviously gold paper doesn't, it's not very, gold leaf paper is not that strong. Go with it. Neo, who kind of has like this kite that has this string on it and was like pretty much strangle people. You have Soji, who uses these kind of, they're a type of card for like gambling and stuff like that. He chucks them at people and it just, it's kind of like throwing, it's like gambit. Not that they don't explode, but they can, you know, cut into people. And then the doctor, Murakami, who I really love, this big buff guy that just has this massive composite bow, and he puts anchors on the thing and just pulls it back and shoots it, all while like busting his clothes off because his muscles get so big. That's kind of the introduction of these characters, and again, they go out and do jobs. The main core story is really around Raizo, his mistake that he made based on the fact that he's being deceived, and how he lost his father, or his father-in-law, eventually his wife, or his fiance, and then over time, so we'll slowly get him pulled back in the story. He sort of tries to find a new walk in life. He doesn't want to be a hired hitman, so he kind of learns about art and wants to get into art and doing that instead, using his hands for something different, and kind of getting into that whole thing, while eventually getting kind of pulled back into the mix. Also, this church that kind of heads all the Revengers, and there'll be a little bit of question mark as to if they're just doing it for the money, not necessarily to get revenge, like this religious, noble cause they're supposed to be doing, and how Usui sort of questions them. But, yeah, I enjoyed the show. It's been a while since I mean, Jinrobuchi stuff has been kind of a question mark for a lot of people. A lot of people assume that Jinrobuchi just puts his names on stuff. But like I said, this is something that he's noted on Twitter as being, you know, something he's wanted to work on for quite a while, doing a samurai story. And I think overall it's a solid story. It definitely feels, it doesn't feel like what most people would assume Jinrobuchi is, like we've joked about the butcher type of story. It does get pretty heavy at the later part. Things kind of hit the fan at the very end of it. But I think overall, this is a very mellow version of Jinrobuchi. I don't even equate to something like Thunderbolt Fantasy that he's been doing for quite a while now. Thunderbolt Fantasy has been just absolute gore fest and just over the top. And I feel like this one's very subdued. What I kind of equate this to is kind of taking the concept of almost Thunderbolt Fantasy, but being very chill about it and not going too over the top. But it still feels kind of grounded in the environment. It feels very period piece, very grounded in reality. And I like it for that. Besides the big muscly man shooting a gigantic a gigantic harpoon at people. Not anchor, a harpoon. That stuff is a little bit over the top. But for the most part, it's very subtle about it. And yeah, technically, Raizo jumping over a huge creek by screaming is a little bit much too. They all have like a little bit of a twist of supernatural in there, like the leaf, gold leaf paper suffocating somebody. But it feels very grounded. What I would say is that it is by far not one of Jenna Bush's best works. This isn't Fate Zero. This isn't Madoka Magica. But it is a nice, refreshing take from him. And the idea that everything feels very well wrote, it feels very grounded, and it feels solid in storytelling. The only criticism I really give it is that it doesn't do anything crazy, but that the last villain was like a bit of a... What? Okay. I mean, there is a faction at the end, but there's an antagonist character that pops up towards the later part, and he just felt just like a cackling bag, like I mentioned earlier with Kaina. Just because he kind of just is crazy, and it wasn't really that interesting. But like I said, everything else was really solidly done. I enjoyed the characters. I especially loved Neo's episode. I think that was a great episode. Really. By far, like, that's Jin. That's Jin Urobuchi that I know. That's that twisted, still grounded, believable type of storytelling that was really well done. But yeah, it's just a solid show overall. If you're looking for a samurai show, it's solid. The action scenes are pretty decently plentiful and they're solid overall. I enjoyed them. When the action gets kicked in, the studio did a good job with it. Visually it looked great. They nailed the setting and everything like that. I really enjoyed it for the most part. I think the only thing that was kind of a little bit left undone was the whole church aspect of it. I think that was kind of the only kind of thing that sort of made me wonder, are you guys going to do another season or something? Because that kind of feels undone, but you can sort of draw your conclusions there. So I enjoyed it. I suggest it, but don't go into expecting Fate Zero or anything like that. But it is a nice take from Jin Urobuchi. I got a kick out of it because ANN made an article, or not an article, one of those dumb little chat, quote-unquote, iMessage-looking articles they do. And they were implying that that Raizo is like this manifestation of Jin Urobuchi's thoughts. Like, he wants to get away from blood and gore, like, what do they call it, dark grim writing. Because Raizo's whole story is that he's a killer for hire, or his master made him kill people for his own cause, and then he decided to put his sword down and use his hand for creating art instead. And so they were thinking that that's like a manifestation of Jin Urobuchi, that he's writing himself into the character, that he wants to get away from dark grim and do nice things. And I'm like, dude, you guys are dumb. He's doing Thunderbolt Fantasy right now, and Thunderbolt Fantasy is grim as hell. He's not trying to write that this is what he wants to do. He enjoys this stuff. He just was telling a different story. So, there you go. That's Revenger. Let's wrap it up. Let's do one more. Don't Toy With Me, Miss Nagatoro, Second Attack. The second season of Miss Nagatoro. For those who don't know, this essentially follows a guy named... He's called Sensei, so it's really weird reading his name for once. Hachi Yoji, who is an artist, and he's got this artist club that he's kind of taking part in, doing art. Some point, he catches the attention of Nagatoro, who is this kind of very seemingly popular girl that's in the school that's, you know, very tan and very loud and very gyaru-ish. And, yeah, she constantly bugs him every single day. Trying to get his attention, because you obviously get a little sense that it seemed like she was really nasty about it at first, but obviously it seems like she kind of likes him, but she doesn't know how to say it. So she constantly makes his life a living hell every day, as he wonders why she always stopped by and why she constantly is at him. So your thoughts on second season? Did you enjoy it? I mean, we introduced the Nagatoro sister, and... Yeah. New year. We got a new Kohai too. That was kind of surprising.
It's one of those odd things that you have that, we've talked about it before, the will they, won't they, here and there. And this one actually did better, honestly, than Uzaki-chan. I will give it a lot of credit there. Absolutely. I love both of them, so don't get me wrong. I think that this one did the pushing the relationship farther better than Uzaki-chan. Like, one of my biggest beefs with Uzaki-chan is they had this effectively a reset
point that they got to that really, really frustrated me. In this one, however, we really did feel – it really felt like that the relationship was becoming a lot more understood between the two characters, and they were actually feeling like they were pushing it forward as far as a coming together. But even this one didn't quite get there, and it's really frustrating, but I absolutely adored it. Nagatoro finding her, understanding her feelings and getting to this point where she's really feeling this tension of, either I need to push it forward or, I might actually miss out. The same thing with Senpai and him actually starting to acknowledge that he doesn't really hate, her teasing and all that stuff. I really did enjoy this season, and I absolutely love the kind of interplay that they are having. This maybe the Kimoi Kimoi is not necessarily I don't like you type Kimoi Kimoi. It's just her way of acknowledging how she feels about Senpai and all that. I love it. I think that they did a fantastic job for this, even if I didn't quite get the resolution I wanted.
Kimoi Kimoi is just her unknowing this feeling of doki doki. It feels Kimoi Kimoi.
It feels Kimoi Kimoi, but it's actually her doki dokis.
I think it is very easy to fall into kind of comparing this to Uzaki-chan, because I think they're both kind really of doing is. The same thing. It is a main character who's being not necessarily teased, but it's like teased to another level in the idea of how it's kind of obnoxious teasing. Like, it's very negative in some respect, or it's too much. And I think what was great about Nagatoro versus Uzaki with the first season was that it felt unsettling at first. And we were like, I don't know, I don't like this. If this is what people were into, this doesn't feel good. This is bullying. She was literally bullying him. And it was more captivating in that first season when you realize, okay, she stopped. Like, she's stopping this. And she even apologized at some point. It was like, whoa, okay. She realized it. It hit heavier than just she shows up and is teasing because she likes him. And I think it still kind of falls in the realm of Uzaki that I want to talk about, because with Uzaki-chan, I agree with you that it feels like a reset. And it feels like nothing really happens in the second season. Now, granted, it gets into her family. Uzaki's family. That was the big thing with second season. And it sort of felt like this was doing the same thing. Suddenly, we're talking about Nagatoro's sister. Like, we're doing it. I got scared. I'm like, oh, crap. This is literally Uzaki-chan's second season. And I almost felt the same fatigue as Uzaki-chan's second season. And the idea of, I'm tired of this joke. Like, I'm tired of the idea. Kimoi, 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 Kimoi. Oh, my gosh. You're so pervy, senpai. And then moves on.
We even got the friends, quote unquote, the friends literally on the outside acknowledging this relationship
between the virginity.
We even had that, which is literally in Uzaki-chan. I mean, they have friends on the outside acknowledging the relationship between these two. So,
like I said, it almost feels like the same writer. And so I did have that fear going into second season, and I did feel that same fatigue. I coined it as the Uzaki-chan sequel syndrome, where it's just this concept of just in general a comedy romance that just gets stuck on this shtick, and at some point you're like, just wrap it up already. Like, just have something happen and move on. But I do agree with you. Unlike Uzaki-chan, it felt like there was a constant progression that's happening, and you're constantly seeing these characters acknowledge their feelings. Getting the whole karate thing and the tournament itself and all that stuff was satisfying. And even in the end, I was very satisfied with how the second season ended. It feels like something is actually happening. To what extent, I won't say for spoiler reasons, but it feels like things are actually happening. They're actually acknowledging each other. While still at the same time being kind of stuck in that joke that obviously made it what it is now, that you kind of wonder, you don't have to keep doing that. Don't feel a necessity that you have to keep doing that. You don't constantly have to have her off the side doing the wiggle wiggle thing and doing the eyeball thing at him every 2 seconds. We've seen it literally for the last 20 plus episodes. We don't have to keep seeing it. move on. So again, it does have its trappings that are getting old. I can admit it is getting old, but I still get that payoff every now and then when something actually progresses.
It's one of those things that you wonder if the writer just can't figure out how to
evolve it.
Yeah,
that was by thigh grabs.
Well, that was my thing is like how maybe it's more along the lines of they're afraid that if they do actually make the relationship a thing,
to conclude it,
they would have to stop.
Shock.
And it's like not necessarily like we were saying, like me and Andrew were saying a second ago, is how do you just have to figure out how to evolve the relationship after that moment happens. And I wonder if they're afraid of how would I change the teasing of Kimoi Kimoi to now we're in a relationship. Can you still do the Kimoi Kimoi? Yeah, you technically can. It's just the way that they interact with each other does shift.
Yeah.
It would be more along
the trigger
the lines,
is different.
Yeah.
It's the same. It's the same result. It's a different trigger.
And that would be the same with Uzaki-chan. I mean, after they become a couple, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't go and hang out at the arcade or over at his house to play a video game. Their interactions will change. I mean, in all actuality, it would become in some ways more intense. And at the same time, it would be a lot more awkward in a lot of cases, because then their feelings are acknowledged. And I mean, it could make for a lot more, special moments between the characters.
Yeah. It makes you wonder if like they could just have like an entire arc where they kind of establish that they're going to go out and then have it where they're just trying to hide it from everybody else. And you could have that whole arc itself. And then eventually, you know, one of them realizes, why are we hiding this? Are we ashamed of our own relationship and do that? Not to say that this season didn't have them establish a relationship. There's a ton of things they can do with it. But again, it's almost like that mix between, do you wonder if they're afraid of establishing that to, again, the whole idol thing that I mentioned earlier, or is an aspect of just not knowing what to do with it once it does that, and being too afraid that it might break what is making the series so popular? Because obviously, we knew it early on. There was a massive fandom around this series that Nagatoro was the greatest thing ever, and that chemistry was great.
And that fandom is the main reason why I pushed through that first couple of episodes, like Andrew had mentioned. I mean, it did feel very, very uncomfortable, those first couple of episodes.
Yeah. That was when I was over in California, and he's literally like contacted me like, I don't know if I like this. I really don't. Anyways, that's Don't Toy With Me, Miss Nagatoro, Second Attack. Check that out if that sounds interesting to you. That's it. We're going to call it there. That's all the reviews we're going to do for now. We'll come back and do another parter later on, but we hope you guys enjoy this run through of the reviews for the winter 2023 anime season. As we usual, at otakuspear.com is where you can go follow all of our links, social media links, ways to support us. We greatly appreciate everybody that supports us. And with that all said, you'll have a fantastic rest of your week, and you'll take care.
Os!